The first and toughest of the Memsahibs made the now dangerous journey through the Punjab to the Kabul cantonment. These included Florentia Sale, the indomitable Indian-born wife of fighting Bob Sale, who arrived in the summer of 1841 with a grand piano and her winsome youngest daughter. Lady Sale had had the foresight to bring enough seeds from her garden in Kanal to fill her Kabul borders with English blooms. "I have cultivated flowers that are the admiration of the Afghan gentleman," she was writing before long. "My sweet peas and geraniums are much admired, and they were all eager to obtain the seed of the edible pea, which flourished well." Shuja now decided to bring his blind brother, Shah Zaman, and both their harems up from Ludhiana in India. Two young Scottish officers, George Broadfoot and Colin Mackenzie, were deputed to the job of escorting the harems to Kabul, a journey which was now a hazardous and uncertain undertaking. From their barracks at Aligarh, the two men made their way to Shuja's harem via the Taj Mahal and a stop to hunt cheetah. On arrival, they found that the caravan now consisted of nearly 6,000 people, which together with their baggage needed 15,000 camels to transport. As they moved on towards Kabul, both men were appalled by the state of Afghanistan. Broadfoot quickly saw how unpopular the British had become, and that the existing garrison was now wholly inadequate to hold the country. "Our apathy in this respect is disgraceful," he exclaimed, "and so is our ignorance of the institutions and manners of the country. Consequently, we fail from our ignorance." At the end of August 1841, Macnaghten received a dispatch from Lord Auckland telling him that the financial breaking point had now been reached. The East India Company had been forced to take out a £5 million loan from Indian merchants at exorbitant rates of interest, just to continue paying salaries. Macnaghten was ordered to make extensive and immediate cuts to expenditure. He chose to aim the cuts at the extremities rather than the centre, and called the Ghilzai and Khyber chieftains to a Durbar in Kabul. There he told them that their subsidies were to be reduced by £8,000. To Macnaghten, it made perfect sense. He believed that the days of the old nobility, as in India, were numbered. In the event, however, it proved to be the single biggest misjudgment of his career, and within weeks it had brought the entire edifice of the occupation crashing down. The Shah's biographer, Herati, noted, "They left him and fled from Kabul back to their hills to open the doors of sedition, raise rebellion, loot the caravans, and block the roads." As part of the cuts, Macnaghten had also decided to send back to India fighting Bob Sale and his brigade. Sale was now instructed to make a detour on his return journey to knock down a few Ghilzai forts and quell any signs of the uprising that he encountered on his way out of the country. The advance guard of Sale's brigade, around 1,000 men, left Kabul on the morning of the 9th of October. They marched to Butkak, a distance of 15 miles from the cantonment. That night, just after dark, as the troops were camped near the mouth of the pass, the sentries heard a strange sound echoing from the shadowy slopes and bare crags above them. Among the younger officers was Thomas Seaton. "Our mess dinner was just over, when the native officers sent in a sepoy to tell the colonel that a great number of people were to be seen assembled on the hill above us, and that he had heard them loading their jazails." Seaton was ordered to take two companies to the foot of the hill where the Afghans were gathered. "I marched off at the head of my men and had scarcely reached my post when the whole hilltop seemed to burst into flame from the simultaneous discharge of hundreds of jazails. Shouts and yells of 'Yelly, yelly, yelly' at the same time rent the air, accompanied by howlings that would have done credit to 1,000 jackals. This onslaught was maintained for upwards of an hour. We had some 40 men killed and wounded." Fighting Bob Sale was promptly sent off on the 12th of October with the rest of his brigade, around 1,600 men in all, to relieve the advance guard and reopen the passes. Their first night at the mouth of the pass was quiet, and the following morning they marched at dawn into the narrow winding heights of the Khord Kabul. No opposition met them until they were fairly entangled in the pass, remembered the chaplain, the Reverend G.R. Glegg. Then, from the rocks and precipices on either side, such a storm of fire opened as told of itself that the heights above were occupied in great force. So skilful, too, were the Afghans in the art of skirmishing, that except by the flashes which their matchlocks emitted, it was impossible to tell where the marksmen lay. The expedition which was supposed to chastise the Ghilzais turned out to have a very different victim to that intended. In the narrow web of the mountain passes, the spider had become the fly, and the hunters found, to their surprise and discomfort, that they had now become the prey. On the morning of the 23rd of October, the beleaguered column advanced again through an especially narrow part of the pass just before Tazin. Turning a corner around two huge rocks, the hills which bounded the valley on all sides were suddenly seen to swarm with Afghans. They again slew, this day, a great many more of our men, and carried off no inconsiderable portion of booty. The following day, after a brief standoff, Sale agreed to admit to his camp a delegation which arrived under flag of truce, and he eventually paid the tribe all they asked. It wasn't until the 2nd of November that Sale's brigade finally emerged from the pass into the plain and reached the small, fertile village of Gundamak. The brigade had so far lost over 250 men in only a few days, and their position was clearly worsening fast. Rather than keep going on to India or return to Kabul, Sale and his officers decided to continue the remaining 35 miles downhill to Jalalabad, refortify the town, and wait to see what happened next. Sale's brigade arrived in Jalalabad on the 12th of November, and managed to seize the town without serious opposition. The following morning, wrote Thomas Seton, a large mixed force of Ghilzai and Shinwari tribesmen appeared on the low hills to the south of the town, and as the day advanced, they came swarming up the rocky heights. The siege of Jalalabad had begun. Across southern Afghanistan, a mass uprising was now clearly imminent. In Kabul, however, McNaughton seemed doggedly determined not to allow any news, however dire, to ruffle his complacency. This was all the more remarkable as the trouble was clearly spreading to Kabul, where the British were now being openly insulted by shopkeepers in the street. Lady Sale was appalled. The general impression is that the envoy is trying to deceive himself into an assurance that the country is in a quiescent state, she noted in her diary. Sir William McNaughton now received news that he had been offered the governorship of Bombay. The man who was most likely to succeed him was Alexander Burnes. He knew Afghanistan better than any other British official or traveller. He loved and understood the country, and his political instincts were as shrewd as his judgment was usually impeccable. But for months, he had been increasingly sidelined by the envoy. Burnes's response was instead to throw himself into the pursuit of pleasure. In this way, he made himself the hate figure he remains to this day in Afghanistan. And it was this, according to the Afghan accounts, that sparked the final, fatal explosion in Kabul. On the evening of the 1st of November, in the first week of Ramadan, the tribal leaders found the flashpoint they were waiting for. It so happened, by God's will, that that night a slave girl of Abdullah Khan Achakzai, ran away from his house to the residence of Alexander Burns, wrote Mirza Atta. The Khan, beside himself with fury, sent his attendant to fetch the silly girl back. The Englishman, swollen with pride, cursing and swearing, had the Khan's attendant severely beaten and thrown out of the house. This was a provocation too far. That very night, wrote Mirza Atta, before dawn had broken, they went to the house of Burns, and with their pitiless swords killed the soldiers that were on guard there. The men of Kabul boarded up their shops, took up arms, and ran to the scene, shouting, "Ya Chahar Yar!" As dawn was breaking, they assembled around the house of Alexander Burns. There are no eyewitness accounts surviving of the final moments of Burns, and the different versions that exist are all to different extents hearsay. The least likely version, though certainly the most imaginative, is that of Mirza Atta. In his narration, when the Ghazis burst into the compound, it is said that Burns at that moment was in the private quarters of the house, taking a bath with his mistress in the hot water of lust and pleasure. At this point, the guerrilla Ghazis burst in and dragged them all from the changing room of life, cut them down with their swords, and threw their corpses into the ash pit of death. Mohanlal, Burns's secretary, gives another version, probably the most credible and certainly the most moving. After fire had consumed the whole of the room, Sir Alexander Burns was obliged to come to the door opening to his garden. Here he implored the multitude to save his life, but receiving a torrent of abuse, abandoned all hopes of safety. On this, he opened up his black neckcloth and tied it on his eyes, that he should not see from what direction the blow of death strikes him. Having done this, he stepped out of the door, and in 1 minute he was cut to pieces by the furious mob. The trunk of Burns's headless body was left in the street to be eaten by the dogs of the city. For nearly a week, no one even thought to try and save anything of his mangled remains. Finally, Burns's friend Naib Sharif, with whom he had spent many a lively evening, sent a servant to pick up the rotting remains and bury them in the garden of Burns's house.
Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan by William Dalrymple was read by Tim Piggott-Smith, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4 and you can hear the next episode at the same time tomorrow. And in a few moments you can hear the Shipping Bulletin before we join the BBC World Service. And now on BBC Radio 4, with the time at 12 minutes to 1, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today, Thursday the 31st of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides and Fair Isle. The general synopsis at 1800, low north at 0964, moving away eastwards, low 300 miles west of Bailey, 980, expected Scotland, 992 by 1800 today. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking north at 0, south at 0.